This is a Ted Malone broadcast from London with news of Corporal Ben Schaub and others. Compliments of Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company. Date, September 8th, 1944. There's three sections.
Westinghouse presents Top of the Evening with Ted Malone, bringing you human interest reports of life and events with our men overseas. Long a best-selling author and radio personality, Ted Malone is winning new fame as Westinghouse overseas correspondent with a new type of reporting that brings us all closer to our men at the front. Now, Ted Malone's recorded shortwave broadcast from the European Theater of Operations.
Hello there, this is Ted Malone overseas. Have you always thought of war as being a very noisy affair? It is usually terribly noisy. The boom of heavy artillery, the crashing thunder of a naval broadside, the din of battle is enormously noisy and frightening. Most of the sounds of war are loud with death, but not all. I have a curious little sound tonight that has saved hundreds of lives. It's so simple and casual you may be completely unimpressed. But against the silence of the pitch-black night in Normandy, this was one of the most welcome sounds in the world. The night the Second Front was opened, thousands of airborne troops in gliders or as parachutists went over on one of the most important and at the same time most perilous assignments of the war. Their job was to land under cover of darkness in the center of German lines and knock out Nazi gun emplacements and communications. In the black night, they never knew whether a shadowy form moving toward them was friend or foe. To challenge, in some cases, would be suicide. But to shoot would mean, in many cases, shooting friends. So some signal had to be devised which would instantly identify friends, yet be so casual a sound it would arouse no suspicion. The solution was very simple. The fellows call it a cricket. And the cricket I borrowed for you to hear tonight was carried through the invasion, many times saving the life of the paratrooper who carried it. Most of the airborne troops are big, husky men, tall and full-muscled. However, one of the lads of the 101st Division isn't much larger than a cricket himself. He's very little over 5 feet tall and weighs just 109 pounds. Pigeon Wilson, they call him. Victor W. Wilson is his name, and he comes from Woodside, Long Island. Small as he is, the nickname Pigeon has no reference to his size. Wilson makes his parachute jump holding two homing pigeons, trained to carry messages back to headquarters. 26 years old, married, and with a two-year-old boy at home, Wilson is an interesting contrast to the uniformly big fellows in his outfit. According to the rule book, no man weighing under 136 pounds can qualify as a paratrooper. But the Pigeon boy is resourceful. He's worked as a cowboy, has been master of ceremonies in New York nightclubs, danced professionally at the World's Fair, and has even had his turn as a schoolteacher. So when the officer told him he was too small for airborne infantry, Pigeon Wilson promptly offered to carry the big officer around the room on his back as many times as any 136-pound man in the room could do it. Convinced by his determination and audacity, the examiner passed him. D-Day, Wilson took his pigeons in and sent home the message, mission accomplished. He made one observation that interested me very much. He said a strange thing happens to a man under combat. Everything seems to expand. A day seems a week long. It's so crowded with intense activity, morning seems at least 3 days ago. But, Pigeon Wilson added, when you're hugging the ground on the edge of a field, and somewhere out there in the dark you hear the signal of a cricket, it may seem ages before you can signal back. But you move, or you try to move, with the speed of lightning. Lieutenant Paul Doubleock of Brookline, Massachusetts, is one of the newest lieutenants in Wilson's outfit. As he earned his lieutenancy the hard way, a battlefield promotion. Lieutenant Paul Doubleock was first sergeant, civilian, and second lieutenant all the same afternoon. Offered his second lieutenancy in recognition of his service as a paratrooper in the invasion, Doubleock had to be discharged from the Army and appointed an officer the same afternoon. During the time he went into London to buy his uniform, he was a mere civilian. I asked Lieutenant Doubleock what it felt like leaping into battle from the sky. He said nobody could really tell anybody else. D-night, he said, the fellows were all in high spirits. They'd been studying maps and sand pictures for weeks. The food had been excellent. They all felt good. Some of them got a little airsick flying over to France, but most of them just talked in the plane or slept. As they reached the continent across the channel, the jump master announced, 20 minutes to go. Everybody began checking guns, chutes, and equipment. 4 minutes from the drop zone, the red light went on in the cabin of the plane, and the fellows stood up, hooked their parachutes in the wire, and began calling off numbers, indicating that they had inspected the fellow in front and he was okay. A minute later, the jump light flashed and the fellow started going out the door. I asked Lieutenant Dovelock what a paratrooper thought about at the moment he stepped through the doorway of the ship out into the air. He couldn't really say. In his case, his outfit had a commanding officer named William Lee. And as a sort of a tribute to him, they all agreed that just as they stepped out into space, each one would shout the CO's name, William Lee, like a college yell. And they did. A college yell in the sky. Sounds of war. Typewriters in the headquarters office, a sentry clicking his heels as he salutes. A college yell in the sky, and a cricket in the dark of the hedgerows somewhere in France. I'll let you hear the sound of one of those crickets used in the invasion of France in just a minute. But first, a word from Westinghouse in New York.
Yes, Ted, we at home are anxiously waiting to hear the sound of those crickets that saved our boys' lives in the invasion of France. And speaking of sounds, when those boys come home, we'll wager they'll really appreciate hearing the appetizing sputter of a savory leg of lamb being roasted to perfection in a Westinghouse electric roaster. And friends, if you own a Westinghouse electric roaster, you know how versatile this efficient cooking appliance is. With it, you can do almost any kind of cooking possible on a regular range. Plugged into any convenient outlet, the roaster can be used for roasting, baking, stewing, or steaming. And with the broiler grid attachment, it broils, toasts, or fries foods as desired. To help you keep this electric servant operating at peak efficiency during wartime, Westinghouse, maker of 30 million electric appliances, offers you a helpful 52-page booklet entitled The Care and Use of Electric Appliances in the Home. This booklet contains a special section with suggestions on how to make simple repairs and adjustments on your present equipment. Every house needs one of these valuable booklets now. Just as for better post-war living, every house needs Westinghouse. To get your copy of the Care and Use book, write Westinghouse, care of this station. Now back to Ted Malone, overseas.
The commanding officers of Corporal Benjamin Schaub, 22, paratrooper of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, have recommended him for special recognition for his part in the invasion. But he modestly insists he didn't do anything more than the rest. D-night, Schaub jumped from the sky over Normandy, carrying his cricket and some 300 pounds additional battle equipment. His M1 gun, grenades, food, clothes, ammunition, and landmines. There was a Nazi machine gun only a few yards away from where he landed in the field. The gunners had raked his parachute in the dark and apparently thought they'd killed him, but they were waiting until morning to investigate. For almost a half hour, the corporal lay motionless in the dark, and then cutting himself free from the shrouds of his chute, he crawled across the field in the dark to the edge of the hedgerows. He knew every move, every sound he made might disclose him to the enemy. But he had to be gone by dawn, or it was all over. Reaching the hedgerow, he waited, listening. He could hear something moving in the next field, and he raised his gun to shoot if the sound came nearer. And he heard the sound of the cricket signal, a friend. Corporal Schaub said, "I would never know how welcome that tiny click was. Listen, and you'll hear the cricket signal that Corporal Schaub referred to." That was all. And similarly simple was the corporal's answer with his cricket. Less dramatic than you may have expected. Believe me, these simple sounds meant the difference between life and death when the men signaled to each other across the field shrouded by darkness. It was some time before the paratroopers of Corporal Schaub's ship assembled. It's not easy to find each other in the dark in the strange country. Again and again, the challenge of the cricket signal clicked in the hedgerows, and sometimes there were answers, and sometimes only silence. And then after breathless waiting and watching and listening, there might be a rifle shot or a burst of machine gun fire or both. sometimes followed by the sound of someone slipping away in the dark. Only grim, ominous silence. One of the first big tasks facing Corporal Schaub's outfit was to knock out a large Nazi gun emplacement in one of the Normandy fields. The paratroopers separated and began crawling up both sides. Some of the Nazis saw one group and opened fire. This was Schaub's chance, he said, and he wriggled into the other end of the Nazi trench and tossed his hand grenade right into the center of them. It was a deadly throw. 14 Nazis died instantly. After I got them killed, the corporal said, Nazi snipers began shooting for me. They were up in the trees all around the field, and for a while I had to lay there in the trench and wait. But one at a time, the snipers were brought down by the rest of the crew, and Corporal Schaub was able to leave the trench where he'd been pinned down. A machine gun nest a couple of fields away was the next. The Nazis had cornered a glider and had the crew zeroed in so that it was only a matter of time until they'd be wiped out. Five of the paratroopers rushed into the field and jumped into a foxhole. It was about 5 feet deep, but filled with water, to within a foot of the top. A chance Nazi shot struck the boy beside Corporal Schaub, and in attempting to hold him up out of the water, a second boy was killed. That left three. They had succeeded in diverting the Nazi fire, however, giving the glider crew time to escape, so the three remaining fellows decided to make a run for it. It meant almost 70 yards across an open field. Dangerous, to be sure, but their position in the water-filled foxhole was constantly getting worse. So, they climbed out and ran. Halfway across the open field, with machine gun bullets striking everywhere, the lieutenant leading was killed. Corporal Schaub miraculously reached the hedgerow, but he was the only one. The third man simply vanished. That night, what was left of the squadron slept in a field near Carentan. When they went to sleep, they were inside American lines. But shortly before dawn, when the sentry on duty saw something moving in the distance and sounded the challenge of the cricket, there was no answer. He tried again. No answer. During the night, the Nazis had counterattacked and retaken the territory where they were sleeping, and once again they were behind Nazi lines. Then followed the terrible days of the Battle of Carentan, when the 101st Division made its fateful drive up Purple Heart Lane to break the back of the Nazi resistance along the beaches of Normandy. Sicily, Salerno, Normandy, southern France, time and again, the airborne infantry with men and boys like Pigeon Wilson, Lieutenant Doubleock, and Corporal Schaub have flown through the night and floated to earth under silken umbrellas, or sailed down silently in the gondolas of gliders, and fought a thousand bitter, blind battles against unknown enemies, shrouded in silence in the dark. Their only way of knowing friend from enemy, the simple click of a tiny cricket. As Lieutenant Doubleock said, I'll never forget the night I heard a click somewhere in the dark, and before I could answer, I could hear the lock thrown on the gun as it was being cocked. And then I answered, and my sergeant told me afterwards another couple of seconds, and he would have let me have it. For the airborne, it's life and death. And as silence meant death, meant enemies, and enemies meant death, so in the invasion of France, the click of a cricket meant friend, and friend meant life. So this simple sound, saving hundreds of lives, will forever be to the airborne infantry one of the memorable sounds of the war. This is Ted Malone wishing you top of the evening and returning you now to New York and to Westinghouse.
Thanks, Ted Malone. And may the sound of the airborne infantry's cricket soon be heard echoing and re-echoing down the streets of Berlin. And friends, when peace does return once more, we shall be living in an electrical age, with many new electrical conveniences in our homes. Among the finest of those appliances will be those that bear the name Westinghouse. Pioneers yesterday, leaders today, trailblazers tomorrow in everything electrical. Westinghouse invites you to hear its Sunday program featuring John Charles Thomas and John Nesbitt over another network. There'll be more recorded shortwave stories from Ted Malone overseas every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, sent to you with the good wishes of Westinghouse. This is the Blue Network.